From the deer-infested studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another defensive hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. One deer can eat 4 to 6 pounds of your precious plants every day. So imagine what a herd of those hungry stomachs on legs could do. I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, we'll discuss several successful ways to defy those deer your dinner. Plus, a heap and helping of your fabulous phone call questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and naturally nuanced negotiations. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens. It's all coming up like you spraying and shocking your biggest garden enemy away.
WDIY has been broadcasting in the Lehigh Valley and beyond for 30 years, providing news.
These planes were hijacked.
The Bethlehem Steel Corporation will end its steelmaking production in Bethlehem.
We hope that you enjoyed hearing from the Dalai Lama.
Local public affairs.
As I say, it's a race of interest.
What we're experiencing today will later on be studied.
And music.
My name is Janice Ian.
Our guest, Lake Street Dive.
In a few minutes, we're going to be talking to Petey Yarrow from Peter, Paul, and Mary.
WDIY, since 1995.
From the Solanaceous Studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another Red Sauce Hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks, you bet your garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and in this week's In the News, we report on a story that originally appeared in a recent edition of National Geographic that may well reveal the true origin of the famed Jersey tomato. Dateline Salem, New Jersey. There are many myths and legends about how the tomato was once called the poison apple, but how it lost its evil reputation and became a beloved piece of produce is more complicated. According to historian Andrew F. Smith, author of The Tomato in America, Early History, Culture, and Cookery, the tale involves a farmer who went to brazen lengths to prove the tomato was safe to eat. Now, the Aztecs are credited with growing and naming the tomato, but when the fruit was brought to Europe in the 16th century, the red color was perceived as sinful and supernatural. By the 18th century, the tomato was nicknamed the poison apple because aristocrats would fall ill or die after consuming them. But it wasn't the tomato that triggered their problems. Instead, it was the pewter plates the wealthy used to dine on, which contained high levels of lead that, when mixed with the natural acidity of the tomato, caused lead poisoning. According to author Smith, large-scale immigration of Italians, who brought with them the wonderful invention of pizza, contributed to the eventual popularity of tomatoes. But it was Robert Gibbon Johnson, a farmer from Salem, who changed the public opinion of tomatoes. According to legend, Johnson stood on Salem's courthouse steps in 1820, eating a basket full of tomatoes for all to see. When he didn't die, word spread that tomatoes were safe to eat. This tale was first mentioned by New Jersey postmaster and historian Joseph S. Sickler in a 1937 book, and quickly became tomato lore. Rich Guido, executive director and librarian of the Salem County Historical Society, believes this type of tall tale to be typical in a small rural town that's passionate about their local history, even if the story may be full of half-truths. On January 30th, 1949, CBS Radio gave the narrative even more notoriety when it broadcast a reenactment of Johnson famously eating the courthouse tomatoes on the show You Are There, for which Sickler acted as a historical consultant. Curtis Harker, records manager at the County of Salem, thinks that the fame of the Salem tomato also involves a certain ketchup company. It's a combination of the love of a huge, flavorful Salem tomato slice plopped on a hamburger and the Heinz companies providing a citywide tomato aroma as they made ketchup for 100 years right there in Salem. Plus, of course, the wonderful story of Farmer Johnson bravely eating tomatoes on the courthouse steps. Although the lore around Johnson has been repeatedly questioned, the story and the tomato continue to maintain their grip on this small New Jersey town.
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Deer are one of a gardener's fiercest problems. They eat 4 to 6 pounds of your stuff a day. What can you do? Well, you can shock them, you can spray them, you can repel them. You have several different options, including giving it all up and fencing them out. We'll deliver the details about all those techniques after more of your fabulous phone calls. 610-694-8100, extension number 3. Maria, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, thank you for being had, Maria. How are you doing?
Very good today. It's hot, but it's...
And where is this we're talking about?
I'm in Morrow, Ohio, probably about 40 minutes northeast of Cincinnati.
Oh, okay. All right. What can we do for Maria in Ohio?
Okay. I bought this plum tree. And I didn't buy it in a nursery. I bought it at a grocery store.
Okay. So this is when?
About 4.5 years ago, I bought this tree.
Okay. Did you only buy one tree?
Yes, I did.
Oh.
It said it didn't need a pollinator. And obviously it didn't because it's bloomed and it's had the plums. It's just that now that it's losing all the plums to that sap that
okay.
I have on it.
Right. It's bleeding sap. Okay. So when did your problems start?
Okay. Last year, the tree bloomed beautifully.
Good.
And I thought I was sure I was going to have plums on it, but then we had a cold snap, and I lost all the flowers. So that year, last year, it didn't bloom, but on the bark, there was this thick sap. But there's no sap on the trunk of the tree anymore. It's just on the fruit.
Okay. So... you've got sap coming out of the trunk, and you are getting fruit now.
Oh, yeah. Lots of fruit. Lots of fruit, but it's got the sap. I can't eat it.
Have you tried just wiping the sap away, or does it go into the fruit?
It goes into the fruit. It's not just on the outside. It's part of the fruit. It's inside.
Gotcha.
I wouldn't be comfortable eating it.
Okay.
You know, because of
no, I understand. Is the tree pruned?
Yes.
And
it is.
How and when?
Mostly I do the pruning after the flowers fall off. I don't do it in the winter.
Right.
But I did it, like last year, I pruned it after the flowers fell off, and I figured it was a good time so the tree would have time to heal. Now, maybe I did that wrong.
No, you did it perfectly.
Okay. I have two cherry trees planted next to it, although I still don't have cherries on my cherry tree. Those are...
Are you sure they're viable in your region?
Well, they were at the store. They said they were, and I did get some flowers on them this year. I just didn't get any cherries. The flowers fell off and didn't make any cherries.
Okay. Don't be surprised if they don't thrive.
Okay.
Now, did you planted these trees yourself?
Yes.
Okay. So what state were they in when you bought them? Were they bare root, or were they in a big pot of dirt?
They were in a pot of dirt.
Okay. Tell me exactly how you planted them.
Okay. I made the hole at least two times bigger than the root ball itself that the pot was.
Okay.
And then I put some good dirt in, and I put some water in there, and then I put the tree in the hole, and then I put dirt, good dirt around it, and then I watered it.
Okay. And you kept up with the watering because the trees didn't die early.
Oh, yes. Yes, I did. Because I read that if you don't keep up with the watering, you're going to lose the tree. So I didn't lose any of my trees.
Right. Well, that is important, especially in the first couple of years. Even 2 years in the ground, it's still considered a new tree. Now, when you planted it, how high or low in the ground? Can you see the root flare, or does it look like a lollipop coming up out of the soil?
No, I don't see a root flare.
Yeah, this is the biggest mistake people make. And you don't have it mulched with wood or anything like that, do you?
Oh, no. No, I heard that was bad, so I don't do that.
Okay. Yeah. It would be good if you could maybe in the winter during a warm day, get some friends over, dig it up, and plant it higher. You want to see that muscular section where the tree meets the roots, and you need to see some above ground roots, because if you bury everything, then part of the bark is underground where it's going to be subject to rotting and insect attack and voles and things like that. So you really want all of the bark above ground. And believe it or not, that's a tree that will not fall over in a storm. It's much more stable than one deeply planted. And just for future reference, you should fill the hole back up with the soil you removed and nothing else. Because if you make it too nice in there, the roots are just going to girdle around themselves. Why would they go out into your lousy clay if they have this nice little womb to live in? So, you know, if you want to try something somewhat drastic, but it sounds like the tree is workable, gently dig it up, get a couple of people with shovels on all sides and bring it up, root ball and all, and then arrange it so that it's high, not low. The idea is to make the hole wide but not deep.
Okay.
And then the regular soil. Now, are there any kind of, it's called canker, and it actually looks like that. Are there any black knots or anything like that?
I don't think so.
Do you feed it?
Yes, I do.
Okay. What do you feed it?
I just get the organic fruit tree mix at Home Depot or Lowe's.
Okay. Well, if it's organic, that's, I'm very proud that that stuff is finally available all over. How often do you feed?
Just once a year I do. Should I do often, more often?
No.
Okay.
And you should feed right after you prune in the spring.
Okay.
And there's no good fruit.
I haven't seen any, and I check the tree every day. The other day I saw one that was pretty, I said, let me just taste it because it wasn't, didn't have that much sap on it. So I took the side, and it was very sweet. It was good. It was good. I just tasted it with my tongue because I said the other side was starting to get affected with the sap, and I didn't want to eat it.
Okay, and pruning, when you've pruned, you've done it to open up the tree, let more air into the center.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, the tree is plenty open up. It's not cluttered at all.
Well, what I would recommend, I mean, there's three or four things it could be, but the advice for all of them is get rid of those plums now.
Okay.
Because they're not going to get any better.
That's what I thought.
And you're disgusted with them, and you might leave them lay on the ground when they fall, and that's going to spread. This is a disease. Again, I'm not sure which of, like, four it could be. But you can look that up. Go to your Ohio State Extension web pages and look up plums in Ohio. But my advice to you is remove all the fruit now and trash it, and then rake the ground so that there's no schmutz down there. And you said that the bark only bled once.
Yes.
Take all the fruits off now and really be nice to the tree. There's nothing wrong with any of the branches, right?
No. No, there isn't.
I wonder if you've got coddling moth. Do you see any insects on the fruit?
Yes, well, they have to be insects because I can see a penetration in the fruit.
Ah.
So wouldn't that mean that there's an insect in there?
Yes. My guess is it's called the coddling moth, and the moth lays its eggs on the fruit. The eggs hatch, and the very small caterpillars go inside and do their damage. Okay. So here's what we do. We're getting rid of all the fruit, making sure that the forest floor is clean. If you can find a source of high-quality compost, mulch around the tree. Start a good foot away from the actual bark, and then go out as far as the canopy goes upstairs. And your extension service will help with the timing. They can also confirm my suspicion that it's this moth. And I want you to have BT, Bacillus thuringiensis. You don't have to remember that part. Just BT. It's been around for 100 years, totally organic. And you would begin spraying that in the spring after pruning, just when the tiniest of the fruits appear. That would kill the caterpillars before they can get inside.
Okay.
They may also have some other suggestions for you, but this sounds totally fixable.
Okay. I was ready to chop it down.
No.
I'll do it your way.
You're not George Washington.
Okay.
And if you were, you'd have to go after one of your cherry trees. So.
Yeah. All right.
Okay.
I will take your advice.
Good luck to you.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody out there that it is critically important to never mow a wet lawn. It rips rather than slices the grass blades, and you'll soon have a brown carpet that was supposed to be green. But don't go checking your moisture meter just yet, because we'll be right back to discuss several ways to deter dastardly deer and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA.
For the past three decades, WDIY has sustained itself through direct contributions from listeners. Our model is simple. The people who listen to the service are the ones who support the service. As WDIY celebrates its landmark 30th anniversary, we invite you to join us as a WDIY member by making a membership gift today. This is something you could do right now to make a meaningful difference in your community. Call 610-694-8000. 8100 extension 4 or online at wdiy.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, dastardly deer, are one of a gardener's fiercest problems. They are big, they are strong, and they can jump well over 5 or 6 feet. And they eat 4 to 6 pounds of your stuff a day. What can you do? You have several different options. We'll deliver the details about all those techniques after more of your fabulous phone calls at 610-694-8100. Brad, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Well, thanks for being had, and we're happy to have you here. Where is here on your end?
I am located in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Oh, okay. Very good. What can we do you for?
Well, I'm calling to get your advice on dealing with Oriental bittersweet and also other invasive species coming into my yard.
Oh, dear. Now, how long have you lived in the house?
I've been here about 2 years now, coming up on 2 years exactly.
And the invasive plants are coming from another neighbor's property?
They are. The neighbor to the right has completely let their yard go for God knows how long.
Mm-hmm.
It's completely overgrown, basically woods, and it is riddled with Oriental bittersweet, and there's also a big tree of heaven in there. And then to the left, I have neighbors whose yard is contained, but they also have a lot of bittersweet growing in their yard, and so this past summer, they actually cut down all the bittersweet that was climbing up the trees back there.
Good.
But they have a lot of it growing out of the ground right now. Like, if I go down and look out, you know, you can just see all the stalks coming up out of the ground in their backyard.
Understood. Now, did they have this done professionally? Did they do it themselves?
They did it themselves, and I also did some of it myself last year. There were some stalks down there growing up the trees that were, you know, maybe 4 to 5 inches thick.
Right.
So I cut those down, and I've ripped a lot of it out of the yard, but it's like, you know, wherever I dig, I find it.
Yeah.
It's completely growing in from the wooded side, so it's like, you know, I've been doing my best to contain it, but I'm looking for advice as to, you know, what I can actually do about this to, you know, get the land back to being basically habitable for native plants. And, you know, like I said, there was a tree of heaven as well on my property that I cut down. You're not going to be happy to hear that I used some glyphosate on it to stop the rhizomes from shooting up. But I did a lot of research, and, you know, I cut that down over the winter after treating the tree. So I got rid of that. And I've cut a lot of the vines back that I could, and I've ripped out as much as I could. But, man, everywhere I dig in the yard, I find these roots.
Yes. Now, have you had allergic reactions? Because I'm going to mispronounce the name of the substance incorrectly, because I can never remember the weird real pronunciation. But uricol oil, the same substance that's in poison ivy, is in Oriental bittersweet. And, you know, people who tackle it without knowing that will often get the oil all over their gloves, all over their doorknobs, all over themselves. And you've not reacted to it?
I have not. Now that you're saying it, though, my girlfriend was doing work in the back, and she did have some sort of reaction. So it's likely that she actually had a reaction to it. But I always wear gloves and long pants and long sleeves when I'm working outside, so I haven't had any trouble yet.
Okay, that's good. But what do you do with the gloves when you're done?
I put them in the basement, and that's it.
Okay. Next time, you put them in the washer.
Okay.
along with your pants and your long sleeve shirt. And just, you don't even need soap. Matter of fact, it's better without soap. Just run it on cool water cycle, and the oil actually is water soluble. So it will dissolve out of the clothing, because many people pick it up when they pull those gloves back on, when they still have their gloves on, when they pet their dog or open the car door or open a door to the house. So it's real easy to spread. Now, I will mention, if you want to really protect yourself, there's a guy I've mentioned frequently on the show who is a professional poison ivy removal specialist. He worked for the Philadelphia Zoo for 20 years, keeping their poison ivy problems under control. And with all the birds they had flying around and poison ivy producing red berries in the fall, he had his work cut out for him. And over the years, he has found several products that he uses with his team to remove like large amounts of poison ivy. And you should at least take a look at them. The website, you'll never forget it, idontwantpoisonivy.com.
All right, that'll be easy to remember.
Yeah, he has special gloves that include gauntlets, like gloves with long sleeves and with washing instructions. Or I think he also has some cheaper ones that you can just throw away. But basically, what you need to do, and again, the size of the vine here tells me that this is well established. And yes, it does climb up into trees and literally pulls them to the ground. Either that, or it gets so profuse that it covers the canopy of the tree and the tree dies from lack of sunlight.
Right.
So be warned, this is one of the most difficult jobs in gardening. How big an area are we talking about?
I would say that my backyard is about, you know, the area that I'm dealing with from the house to the back is about maybe 60 feet by 50 feet wide.
Okay, so it's relatively small.
Yes. Yes, okay. I'm in a city, so not too big.
Have you spoken to the neighbor with the overgrown yard?
I have not. No. I think that he has no interest, from what I can tell, in dealing with any of this, though. And I've actually been cutting into his yard and ripping a lot of it out. And, you know, he's not around to talk or care or anything like that.
Okay. I want you to see, you're in Massachusetts or Maine? Which was it?
Massachusetts.
Massachusetts. I want you to call the county courthouse and see if they have a weed ordinance, in which people who've neglected their properties are either forced to clean it up themselves, or the township will come and do it for them and then send them a bill. This is a very difficult job for a regular human to do. And you're not going to solve it till you get him under control. This is a really annoying invasive, in that it is listed as invasive in many, if not most, states, but you can still buy it at nurseries.
Yeah, it's unreal, honestly.
Absolutely crazy. So the short answer is the same as when we have a poison ivy vine growing up the side of a tree that's become very large. And that's you don protective clothing, you know, especially if you go out and buy some really inexpensive but heavy-duty gloves that you can just keep changing in a bucket of water, so to speak, and then wash them at the end of the day. But what you have to do is cut the vine off where it enters or leaves the ground, depending on which way you look at it. And then be patient. Once it's separated from the roots, the above ground growth will die. And the plant will slowly brown out. And it's much easier to pull it out of the tree canopy after that. You don't want to try to muscle it while it still has sap and energy in it. You'll lose.
Right.
And then you have to devise a way to pull it down, knowing that anybody who's helping you or you could have a severe allergic reaction to any part you touch. So be careful with that. And this is a case where you put it in a trash bag, put it out with the trash. Even if your community has rules against doing that, you're allowed to do it with invasives. You don't want to burn it because the smoke will be as toxic as poison ivy smoke. And then you take your Roundup, say three Hail Marys and a perfect act of contrition, take it to the next hazardous waste disposal clinic, and get high-strength vinegar. Regular vinegar is, quote, diluted with water to 5%. So vinegar comes out of the barrel much stronger than that. But we don't want that kind of stuff in the kitchen, so they dilute it to 5%, and that's good enough for pickling and preserving.
Right.
But you can buy it in heavier concentrations and wear eye protection and keep an eye on the base around the tree and spray the new sprouts as soon as you see them. Really saturate them, especially if you can do this during a hot, dry spell. By not allowing the greenery of a new sprout to mature, you will starve the root and it will go away that way. Otherwise, you would literally have to have your whole backyard excavated to get rid of it all. Your climate is not conducive to solarization, so it would be a manual dig up. Do you ever think about having a swimming pool in your backyard?
It's a little bit of a hill, so I don't think that that would work too well. I am curious what your thoughts are on potentially trenching around the edges of my property and putting in a weed barrier to essentially create an island.
That's an excellent idea, but you don't want a, quote, weed barrier. You want a special product called rhizome barrier. That's designed to keep bamboo out of areas that aren't corrupted by the bamboo yet. So it's well known. Most landscapers are very familiar with rhizome barrier, and they have the trenching tools that will make the job easy. And they'll know exactly how far down to go to stop the lateral growth. But yes, rhizome barrier in your case, especially with the size, is an excellent idea. And after that, it's diligence. Once you get the main vines down and you're preventing regrowth near the tree that they're wrapped around, then I would sacrifice my lawn to some degree by mowing constantly at a level of 1 inch, not the 3 to 3.5 inches I normally recommend. That way, you'll cut all that growth down to the ground, again, before it can gain enough biomass to accumulate solar energy. So just relentlessly mow the whole summer, especially, again, when it's hot and dry, which I hope it will be sometime during my summer here in Pennsylvania. I'm sick of the rain. Do you hear me? I'm totally sick of it.
Truly. Same. It's cold and rainy.
Oh, God, I'm so tired of it. If I wanted to live in Seattle, I'd at least get the water and that fabulous island out there.
Exactly.
Know?
Yep. Yep.
So that's it. There's no secret. Again, be careful. You know, the susceptibility to the urosol oil varies greatly from person to person. Mm-hmm. And I want to repeat, for anybody who has a plant like this that is, you know, has a toxic oil or an allergenic oil, if you get whipped, you know, with a branch or a vine or anything like that, immediately stop what you're doing. Have a garden hose nearby. Have somebody turn it on for you and just wash down that area with cold water. You got 20 minutes before a reaction can start, and the water will literally dissolve the oil, and it'll be gone.
All right. Well, that is great to know. And, yeah, I mean, I will say going into this phone call, from all the research that I've done, I definitely learned that this is going to be a year's, you know, year's project.
Yes, but the nice thing about this, and I've done this many times advising people with running bamboo, is the first year it's like, oh, I didn't get anything done. It's as bad as ever. And the second year you go, huh, I don't know. The stuff that's coming up now looks a little weak and scraggly. Then by the third year, it looks like blades of grass. Mm-hmm. And then it's gone. Then it's dead. Because you have to starve the root.
Yep.
All right. Brad?
Yeah.
You got your.
It's going to be a task.
You got your work cut out for you, but
definitely.
You know, gardening was never meant for the timid.
Indeed. Yep. Well, thank you for your advice. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good luck, sir.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind all of you what are trying to grow a healthy lawn that having a super sharp blade for your mower is key to success. A sharp blade ensures a clean cut that will heal quickly. A dull blade will shred the grass and make it impossible for the blades to hold water. But don't go shopping for that fresh blade just yet, because we'll be right back to help you get rid of dastardly deer and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. The lanternflies are coming. The lanternflies are coming. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss new research that identifies their natural enemies. It's bug against bug. Plus, can the third world help us repair our damaged farming systems? And your fabulous phone calls. That's on the next You Bet Your Garden. Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and we are in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will name four or five different ways to keep deer off of your landscape, out of your garden. Before that, however, another one of your fabulous phone calls at 610-694-8100. Andrea, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. It's wonderful to talk with you.
It's wonderful to talk with you, too. Whereabouts are you?
I am in the Maryland suburbs of D.C., about a half an hour north in Zone 7.
Okay.
And I am not far from a city called Rockville.
I know it.
Because the soil is basically clay and rocks.
Right.
And I decided I wanted to have a greenhouse. So I had some workers pour a foundation and build a cinder block wall to level out a hill so I can put an 8x10 greenhouse in there. And I was going to plant directly in the bottom in the raised area, but the workers dumped cinder blocks, rocks, clay, pieces of brick into what was going to be my garden bed. So, okay, I'll put raised beds inside my greenhouse. But on top of what? One neighbor suggests putting a layer of stone gravel across all the nastiness. Another said just put down cardboard under the open box bottoms of the boxes. A third one said to build them up on sticks or stilts.
Okay. Now, what is the floor of your greenhouse like? Is it literally full of rocks?
The surface looks like clay-colored dirt with flecks of rocks and lots of weeds right now.
Okay, because you were kind of describing them leaving rubble. Okay, so here's what you do. I'm going to choose door number two from your neighbor's advice. What you want to do is build raised beds. In a way, you really got to measure. 8x10 is not a lot of room. So you really got to measure what you can fit in there. And remember, you need 2 feet of walking lanes. And what you do is you do lay one sheet of cardboard underneath the raised bed frames. And then you fill the raised beds with a mixture of screened topsoil, perlite, very important with perlite, and high quality compost. And if you're going to be buying the topsoil and compost in bulk, you want to go to the nursery, you want to see it, you want to smell it, and you want to feel it. And then just be aware that greenhouses aren't magic. You'll be able to start your seeds in there, say a month early in the season, and you'll be able to take tender plants like peppers in there from September through November. But the greenhouse is not heated, so it's not going to protect plants from freezing if it's a freezing temperature outside. And if you're going to have plants growing in there over the summer, you have to make sure it's well vented, because the sun going through the glass will heat that greenhouse up to 120 degrees.
Yes. I was gifted a solar panel powered generator, and I was thinking I could plug either a heater or a fan into it if I get that integrated into the roof when I'm building it.
That sounds really dicey. Didn't the greenhouse itself come with an automatic vent?
Yes, it has an automatic vent that based on heat.
Yes. Well, yes. That's what's important. Because the vent hopefully is in the very top of the ceiling, the hot air will move out rapidly. You can also leave the door ajar, or hopefully the door has a screen.
I got to keep the bleeping rabbits out, so I don't know if I'll keep the door ajar.
Okay, so can the door be fitted with a screen, or does it have one?
That's a good question. I don't know. I haven't taken it out of the box yet.
Oh, okay. Well, when you're looking at the door, what you want is just like the front doors I grew up with, where you got a piece of glass that goes up and down, and behind it you got a screen. So you raise the glass up when it's warm, and you lower the glass down when it's cold. You want to do everything you can without electricity, so to speak, passively. You'll be much happier.
Okay.
All right. So,
thank you so much. I'll head out for some cardboard next.
Okay, good. Yeah, if you go to any of the big box stores, they tend to have tons from refrigerators and washer dryers and stuff like that.
Okay. I thank you for that information. I appreciate it very much.
All right. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it is time for the question of the week. Several successful ways to deal with dastardly deer. Susan in Cambridge, the one on the eastern shore of Maryland, writes, "Hi, Mike. I'm a former Bucks County listener who still loves all things Philly, especially the accent, because I got it too. Anyway, hubby and I love it here on the eastern shore, but we are at our wits' end with the deer eating everything we try to plant around our new home. I saw a suggestion for Mylar tape online, and that sounded interesting. Any advice for us?" Well, of course, but first, what's this about an accent? What accent? Sounds like yous need to drink more water. I think you're referring to a product called Bird Scare Flash Tape. The original version, which is still around, comes on a roll and is about as wide as reel-to-reel recording tape. But there are now many other options, including some versions as wide as duct tape. All flash tape is designed to move around in the slightest breeze, reflecting all sorts of bright and shiny colors and make a snapping noise as it waves in the wind. Originally designed to scare birds away from fruits like service berries and blueberries, it might scare deer away, especially in windy areas. Hello, Oklahoma. And it sure is an inexpensive option to try. But my first overall suggestion is deer fencing. I will never forget the photo that showed a wooded area with a fence down the middle that had been built to protect the edge of a native plant sanctuary. The sanctuary side of the fence remained unravaged. The unprotected area was dead, lifeless, and eaten to the ground. Experts agree that properly installed deer fencing is the absolute best protection. The materials that make up the fencing are designed to be invisible from 20 feet away, thanks to their color and design. But the fence needs to be well supported and at least 7 feet tall. Some sources say 6 feet is high enough. Others insist it should be 8 foot tall. And I have seen deer with broken legs writhing in gardens surrounded by 5 or 6 foot high fencing, and it was not pretty. So don't skimp, go for at least 7 feet. Yes, fencing is the most expensive option, but it amortizes well over the years and is perfect if you have a contained area to protect. Just don't try and save money here. Pay for high-quality materials and expert installation, or you will end up with an expensive failure. Some fed-up homeowners, and most arboretums and horticultural showplaces, have opted for deer fencing, with cattle guards in the ground to prevent deer from wandering down driveways and service roads. Next up, motion-activated sprinklers. I use them to protect my raised beds and a few hosta lucky enough to be planted close by. The devices have a, quote, head that contains a motion detector, batteries to power it, and a stake to anchor it in the ground. You hook it up to a garden hose and turn the hose into the on position. When the motion detector senses a nearby object, it comes alive with a loud spurt and shoots a couple cups of cold water at the object. The bigger the target, the better, and deer are a nice big size. I went for the optional tall tripod stand instead of the included small garden stake, which greatly improved its usefulness. And yes, you will forget the sprinkler is there and get a wet wake-up call one morning. Just remember not to drop your coffee mug. Warning, while researching my choices, I came across a website that seemed to be a list of ways to repel deer. But it claimed deer got used to being sprayed by motion detectors, and they soon lost their effectiveness. Huh, not in my case. But then I read further, and the whole thing turned out to be a clever ad for a sonic motion detector, which research has shown not to work. In fact, roaches were famously attracted to a smaller indoor sonic device when it was tested. But you can't use a motion-detecting sprinkler in freezing weather, or your hose will burst. Which brings us to the wireless deer fence, which is still made and shipped by the family of the original inventor in Indiana. It costs $70 for three devices and a pack of 36 deer-attracting scent pellets. That's right, deer-attracting. There's a small metal basket on top of the 19-inch round green device in which you place a scent pellet on a little peg. Then you install two AA batteries in the belly of the beast, which are protected from rain by O-rings, and place it where you wish to deter deer. A battery-powered capacitor inside builds up a charge. The deer are attracted by the scent pellet, lick it, get a mild shock, and run off to eat somebody else's salad greens. By the way, the wireless deer fence is especially effective for low-to-the-ground plants. It is suggested that the batteries be replaced every 6 months, and the extra pellets are replacements to keep the scent strong. The package comes with a small screwdriver-like device that you can use to safely replace the pellets without getting shocked. I rely on these things in the winter, when I can't use water, obviously, and to protect important plants that aren't near my garden proper. Repellents. You want a product with the strongest, most concentrated smell. And to use repellents effectively, you should begin spraying your plants as soon as they leaf out in the spring. But don't waste money by spraying the whole plant. You only want to spray a double dose of repellent right at deer grazing height, which is generally between 3 and 5 feet off the ground. That way, the deer will get a double mouthful of nasty, and you won't waste money. Spray that area repeatedly early in the season, and you may even be able to, quote, prime your four-legged foes into avoiding your plants later in the year. Well, that sure was some hopefully helpful advice about defying dastardly deer. Now, wasn't it? Luckily, you can read the details over at your leisure or your leisure by following the link for the Gardens Alive question of the week at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Yikes, my producer is threatening to turn off my motion-activated sprinklers if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you, yes, you can call us anytime at 610-694-8100, extension number 3. We really love your phone calls. And or send us your email. You're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. No matter how you contact us, please include your location. And be sure to visit that Facebook page, where we post lots of new photos of stuff that looks good in my garden. You won't see pictures of the other stuff. Important and informative updates about the show, a link to the written version of the Gardens Alive question of the week, and links to our priceless podcast. It's all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the studios of NPR station WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when he got hit in the head with a lawn dart and nobody noticed for 5 days. Our musical director is Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Norfleet. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Ziprote. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our executive producer is the always lovely Jonas Bowen. And our incredible assistant is the awesome Ninja Sean. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'll be keeping a watchful eye on my previously drowned plants to see how well and if they recover now that we're finally seeing some sun, or as I call it, bright light in the sky. Hurt my eyes. And we're sure we'll see you again right here next week.